Very good morning to everyone. The court apologizes for the delay in beginning the session this morning. The first case is number 023914, the United States against the BD O'Sidon. Mr. Rubenstein.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Corey Rubenstein on behalf of the Does and the Rows. Your Honors, the summonses which are at issue in this case relate to an investigation whose stated purpose was to determine liability of BDO seamen for certain potential violations of what the government has said may be failure to comply with certain registration and listing requirements under the code. Significant, the investigation's purpose is not to determine the liability of our clients. However, the summonses, when they're reviewed and when they're attempted to be responded to, the clear purpose of which is to determine the identity of individuals otherwise unknown to the service who have come to BDO for the express purpose of seeking advice regarding a particular category of tax issues, in particular tax matters, determining ways to lessen a client's potential tax burden. In issuing these summonses and seeking to discover the identity of these individuals, the government is essentially using the client's very act of going to a tax professional who the client believes he has some sort of a privileged relationship with, and using that act as a basis for targeting those individuals for further investigation. This is exactly the kind of situation which the identity privilege, which is something of a misnomer, but the identity privilege has been recognized to protect against in the attorney-client context.
What are the client's expectations based on?
The client's expectations are based on, first of all, the statute itself, which says that there is a privilege. And that statute is actually referenced in the engagement letters, which are executed between BDO and its clients. It's based also on the fact that, like all taxpayers, there's an expectation and knowledge that there's some sort of an adversarial relationship in some occurrences between the taxpayer and the service. And the very purpose of the privilege, as enacted by Congress, was to recognize that that tension exists and that to foster the ability of individuals to seek lawful ways to reduce their tax burden. A function, by the way, which I think is considered by Congress to be socially desirable. Congress clearly has said there's no benefit to paying a dollar more than you are absolutely required by law to pay for the federal government. And to foster that that function, this privilege has been enacted, and there has been an expectation on the part of clients that not only lawyers who provide tax advice, but tax professionals in general who are within the scope of the privilege will be able to have this kind of relationship on a confidential and privileged basis. What the government has done through these summonses is substantively no different than if the U.S. Attorney's Office, for example, had issued grand jury subpoenas and had served those grand jury subpoenas, say, on a law firm which is known, well known, to represent white-collar clients in connection with potential criminal exposure. Whether those subpoenas are defined by the nature of the advice given or a particular category of advice or even the existence of an ongoing investigation, I don't think this court would have any trouble recognizing that, for example, in the context of the ongoing investigation of the Illinois Secretary of State's office, somebody came to Stetler and Duffy and said, "We know you represent a lot of people in connection with these kind of matters. Tell us the names of those people who you represent in connection with this investigation."
Suppose you were to prevail in this case, and suppose next year you were appointed Commissioner of the Internal Revenue, and you had to come up and map out how you were going to conduct an investigation like this one, living with our decision. How would you go about doing it?
Well, I think I do it the way that the way that has been suggested in the briefs, which is simply go to the target of the investigation, which is BDO Seamen in this case, and say, give us the information that will help us determine whether or not you violated these provisions of law. They don't need the client identities to do that. Apparently, the controversy below is whether or not the transactions that are at issue fall within the scope of the provisions which require registration and listing. That can presumably be done by obtaining documents and information from BDO, either in redacted form or documents that don't reference clients at all, which will define the scope of transactions but not define or identify the participants in those transactions. There's absolutely no need or necessity for the service to identify particular clients of BDO. I suppose the service would say, well, it would be helpful if, in addition to what you suggested, counsel, we can also go to the clients and corroborate that that's what happened and maybe turn those clients against BDO and obtain additional information which may be of use. Well, that's true enough, maybe, but I think it's beside the point. The privilege is to protect the client, not BDO, and in this case, BDO's client's identities are privileged for exactly the purpose of not allowing this kind of sort of a fishing expedition.
At this point, have your clients established that they are in fact entitled to the privilege under the usual legal test for invoking the privilege?
Yes, they have. They've established all the elements. I don't think there's any question to that. They were clearly clients of BDO who went to BDO for the provision of tax advice. There's no evidence of waiver anywhere. And it's the test is straightforward. I don't think.
Do you know whether the transactions were with BDO were undertaken before or after the effective date of the statute?
I would say that we know that based on the pleadings that we filed to enter into these to seek intervention. Has there been any evidence other than the pleadings that have been filed? I don't know that there has.
On the remand, was any attempt made to take care of that problem?
I don't think this court remanded, so it would know better than counsel, but I don't think the remand was targeted at the question of the timing of the transactions. I think that would be a fairly simple task, and I don't think it's going to be an issue. I think the remand was addressed to the broader issues raised by the government below, not all of which we submit have been answered by the district court due to the strange series of events that led to Judge Holderman being assigned to this case.
I have a somewhat time-related question. How did the proposed interveners learn about the transactions? Were they approached or solicited by BDO, or did they approach BDO? And was it in the context of other tax services?
It's an interesting question, Judge, and the government has said in their reply brief, which we have not responded to, obviously, the following. They say, BDO peddled its products through cold calling and intermediaries, presumably meaning to these clients. There's absolutely no evidence in the record of that. That's just taking blatant liberty with the record. I think there really is no evidence one way or the other, but I think the evidence would show that at least with a large percentage of these clients, they were pre-existing clients of BDO for tax matters, or were potentially referred to BDO by their own personal lawyers or tax practitioners. The idea that this was some sort of a marketing scheme, which people were calling 1-900 numbers and trying to win a free trip to Florida, just has no basis in the record.
But of course, so you're saying there's nothing in the record to indicate one way or another, so we don't have any finding by Judge Holderman on that.
We don't, Judge. We do have the signed agreements, which don't indicate exactly how the clients came there, but are agreements nonetheless, which demonstrate the existence of the relationship. The government's primary fallback argument to the question of whether the identity privilege applies at all or exists at all under the tax practitioner privilege is that what BDO was doing here wasn't really providing tax advice. The government takes some pains to try to characterize this relationship in ways other than a tax advisor client relationship. For example, calling BDO again and again, a promoter of PAC shelters, and suggesting that, first of all, that's somehow inconsistent with providing advice, but not having, again, really any record support to indicate that BDO promoted PAC shelters to these clients in any way whatsoever. The characterization, whatever it is again, really immaterial. There's no question here that the only thing that BDO had, whether you call it selling itself or providing services to these clients, was its expertise and its counsel on tax matters. It wasn't providing a thing of substance. It was intangible things. It was its advice. And the written agreements, again, demonstrate this, where they say that the services to be provided include assisting the client in attaining beneficial tax results from structuring their affairs in a particular way. The district court did not address those provisions directly, but instead addressed an independent provision relating to a limitation on BDO's liability, potential liability, for consequential damages of some sort. In doing that, the district court essentially said, well, to the extent the tax practitioner, tax professional is limiting its liability, can't really be considered an advisor. That clearly isn't what that provision means. The provision is a boilerplate type of exculpatory provision in a civil contract. It's not surprising nor significant that the provision is in place, given the nature and size of the transactions that BDO was advising its clients about. The fact that BDO didn't wish to become sort of an underwriter or insurer for these transactions doesn't mean that it wasn't providing advice. It clearly was. And that fact was confirmed and indeed unrebutted by the testimony or the affidavit of BDO partner Robert Greitzman, who said, the core of what we're doing is providing tax advice. And the district court completely ignored that affidavit in reaching its contrary findings. The alternative or second alternative argument that the government offers, I see I'm in rebuttal time, and unless the court has questions, I'd reserve for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Rubin.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Peter Buscemi on behalf of BDO Seidman LLP. I'd like to begin my brief remarks with a mention of the procedural posture of this case. This is a summons enforcement proceeding. There has been no finding of wrongdoing on the part of my client, much less on the part of any of the client interveners. I think the government has erred in a number of its submissions, both in this court and in the district court, by putting the cart before the horse and asserting at the very outset of its brief that our client was engaged in the promotion of abusive tax shelters. The rest of their argument is based on that very flawed foundation. Everything that they say, they build on that. For example, they try to rely on Section 6112 of the Internal Revenue Code, saying that there can't possibly be any privilege such as that claimed by the interveners because our client would need to provide a list of investors under Section 6112. Well, of course, that only is true if the transaction was a registrable transaction under Section 6111, and we don't believe that it was. So there is no registration requirement nor any list-keeping requirement. I think furthermore,
what do you think the government has to show before they go any further? How do they establish that indeed the products are within the scope of the statute?
Well, Your Honor, they need to show what Section 6111 requires. The key provision of Section 6111 talks about the ratio of deductions and tax credits to the investment base of the investor, and that ratio under Section 6111 needs to be greater than 2-1. No such showing has been made. And I think it's apparent that the names of the taxpayers don't have any bearing on that question. The ratio either is or isn't what the statute requires, and the government has made no showing that it is.
As a practical matter, can the government ascertain that information without ascertaining the names of the individuals involved?
I don't see any reason why not. In fact, there are taxpayers who did not choose to intervene. The government has received approximately 80 boxes of documents in response to the summonses that it served on our client, and the government, as far as I know, is reviewing those documents as we speak. Moreover, Mr. Rubenstein's point is well taken. To the extent the government is interested in the substance of the transactions in which the proposed interveners engaged, that information is readily available through redacted documents. Everything but the taxpayer's name would be available to the government with respect to the documents that are at issue here. We have claimed privilege with respect to the content of tax opinions and other tax advice that our firm gave to its clients, that counsel gave to our firm. Those documents are listed on a privilege log. Those documents are not at issue here. Those documents have not yet been addressed in the district court. The documents that are at issue here are a subset of those that the district court ordered to be produced, but that have been withheld because production in unredacted form would reveal the intervener's name. A couple of other arguments that I should just mention briefly, because I don't think Mr. Rubenstein had a chance, and they do go beyond just this claim of the privilege to protect the identity of the interveners. They may have an impact on the claims of privilege with respect to the content of certain documents, and those are the arguments that the government has advanced regarding the preparation of tax returns on the one hand and regarding the corporate tax shelter exception. We have addressed those in our briefs. I think that they are without merit. It is true that this court has held in the Frederick case, for example, that if information is provided for the purpose of enabling the preparation of a tax return, that information is not privileged. But as the court held in the In Re Grand Jury proceeding case less than 3 years ago, the mere fact that an attorney is in possession of certain information and that the attorney also prepared the tax return doesn't necessarily mean that the information was provided to the attorney for the purpose of preparing the tax return, and that's why the court remanded to the district court in that case for further fact-finding. So I think the same thing is true here. It is true that BDO Seidman prepared certain clients' tax returns, but that doesn't mean that the tax advice that BDO Seidman provided was provided for the purpose of preparing the tax return. That's a non sequitur. It doesn't follow, and the government's argument based on the tax return preparation is, we think, without merit. The same thing applies to the 7525B exception. These are not corporate tax shelters. All of the interveners are individuals. There is no effort here to reduce or evade corporate tax.
Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll hear from the government now.
May it please the court, Frank Seiler for the government. I'm accompanied at council table by Leon O'Connor, Assistant Attorney General of the Tax Division, and John Lindquist, our Chief Trial Attorney in this case. Appellants have no colorable claim of privilege under Section 7525 and thus no right to intervene in this proceeding. General principles, we all agree, of the attorney that apply to the attorney-client privilege apply with equal force to the assertion of the privilege under 7525. Only disclosures necessary to obtain informed legal advice, and that would not be made without the privilege, are protected. But the privilege cannot stand in the face of countervailing law or strong public policy and should be strictly confined within the narrowest possible limits underlying its scope. In this instance, both Section 6112 5112 mandate that promoters of abusive tax shelters disclose the names of their investors to the IRS, and the very strong public policy against concealing the identity of a client foreclose any claim that appellant's identities are privileged. And I think it'd be worthwhile to note the put this in the factual context and note that BDO in the first instance did not assert any privilege with respect to the documents that are issued on this appeal. And it's probably helpful to know that there are several categories of documents. We've gotten certain documents from BDO as to which no privilege has been asserted. At present time, there are some 3,600 documents as to which they have asserted a claim of privilege. Then there were the documents as to which no claim was made, which were the subject of the production order. And it's those documents, and the production of those documents that the appellants have asked to intervene in, and it's those documents they're trying to keep from being disclosed to the service. There's no assertion, indeed appellants concede, that those documents contain no privileged information other than their identities. They have offered to produce redacted copies of those documents which give us everything save their identities. That flies in the face of the notion that whenever, whatever privilege might apply, a client's identity is presumptively not privileged. Now certainly, 5112 requires that the promoter of a potentially abusive tax shelter maintain and provide a list of investors in the shelter. This is an investigation of BDO for its compliance with Section 6111 and 6112.
Let me ask you this question. Do you have to determine if BDO's transactions were tax shelters for which record keeping is required under 611 before you can require reporting of investors under 6112?
No, 6112 is broader, among other things, 6112 is broader than 6111. 6112 encompasses both shelters that are required to be registered under 6111, as well as shelters that the commissioner has determined are potentially abusive by regulation. And what we're talking about here are exactly that, shelters that the commissioner by regulation has determined to be abusive and has reason to believe the BDO has been promoting.
Why do you need the names to determine that?
For a number of reasons. Under 6111, the definition of, for example, of the tax shelter has to do with the representations made about the benefits to be accorded the investor. We need to talk to the investors to find out what those representations were. And we're entitled to it. And there's no, and keep in mind, we start with the premise that identity is not privileged. They have the burden of establishing that any privilege would obtain. They have not met that burden. The only instances in which courts have held a client's identity have held a client's identity to be privileged are instances in which disclosure of the identity would be incriminating or otherwise disclose the full substance of a confidential communication. Neither incident is present here. There's been no suggestion that the disclosure of their identities would be in any way incriminating. Nor is there any suggestion, there's a suggestion, which is without merit, that if we know their identities, we know the substance of the communication. That is not true. We know the subject matter. And as the Third Circuit Lincoln pointed out, there's a distinction between disclosing or knowing the subject matter of the communication and knowing the substance of the communication. We don't know the substance of any communication that may have been had. Indeed, I assume that the whole purpose of asserting the privilege as to the 3,600 documents is to maintain the privacy of any such substance.
If I have this correct, the commissioner's already determined these to be abusive.
No, it's an investigation. You know, the sales process is investigatory. We'll determine certain types of transactions that are abusive, political transactions, and the group of these transactions are either on that list or substantially similar to transactions on that list. And there are some reasons for believing that. As indicated, our brief, this investigator started with an informant, telling the service that BDO have been engaged in promoting such shelters. It's part of a amnesty program that the sheriff entered into. A number of taxpayers came forward, and the Forest Service, they had invested in transactions promoted by BDO that fell within the definition of one of the, notice 2044, one of the listed transactions. You can see in the declaration filed by IRS agent Friedman at supplemental appendix pages 19 and 20. He lists at least six investors who have provided that information to the service. We don't have to establish that these transactions, we don't have to prove there's a liability before we start investigating. That would truly put the cart before the horse. But we certainly have ample reason to investigate BDO in this instance. Ample reason for believing that the fact they have been promoting.
Has that ample reason been really subject to judicial scrutiny yet?
It's premature. This is an investigation. Bear in mind, we get the information, like any examination. We look at the transaction, and the commissioner will make a determination, yay or nay, as to whether they agree with the taxpayer. They may agree these are perfectly legitimate. I'm not going to suggest that's likely, but that's a possibility. If there's a determination that anybody owes more tax or penalty, there are administrative procedures be pursued. Beyond that, court procedures. They can contest the determination in court. Beyond that, they may be back here. So, this is quite preliminary. There shouldn't be, there's no need to have a determination at this point that these, in fact, our shelters. That's not what it's all about. This is an investigation into a potential liability.
And there's no legal requirement that you get the imprimatur of the court to proceed on this investigation.
Not at all.
Let me ask you this. If the names are revealed, could that lead to potential liability for income tax evasion investigations of the proposed intervenors? I mean, something broader than whether or not the tax shelters.
Criminal investigation?
Mm-hmm.
I suppose it could. If it did, of course, we'd be in a whole different ballgame, because what you're suggesting is there may be criminal activity. And of course, if there were, presumably you're talking about activity that was instigated by, promoted by, the proposed advisor here, so you'd be talking the crime fraud exception. I suppose that I can't say that possibility isn't there, but if it's how it is, it's all the more reason to deny the claim of privilege.
But you have right now no basis to believe that any of the interveners fall into that category.
I have no idea who they are, so I can't
right.
say that now.
Yes,
no.
I understand. No.
You do have the ones that didn't intervene, though. You have information with regard to those.
As I understand, we have information on a number of their investors, names of those investors, and they're being looked at.
Well, with the documents you have, one of the points counsel made was, with the documents you do have, you should be able to determine that ratio. Are you able to do that, and why do you need the identities revealed?
It's up to the service. I mean, Congress has established a federal agency that's charged with making these determinations of first instance, for instance, the IRS. We don't have to take the taxpayer's word on whether or not these are potentially abusive tax shelters, which is really what counsel is suggesting. We're entitled to make that determination for ourselves. We're entitled to talk to investors and ask them what representations are made. We're entitled to talk to investors to find out what fees they actually paid. Keep in mind the penalties the BDO might be subject to in part depend upon the amount of fees they've been paid for promoting these shelters. We're entitled to that information, entitled to audit it, to examine it. That's what the service and the business are doing. Not to take somebody's word. That's not the point. Moreover, the Supreme Court has also held that we're entitled, if using a summary such as this, to be interfering for good purpose. Typically, fine arts, the Supreme Court clearly held that if we turn up information that the individuals are themselves liable, then we can pursue them for civil tax liability. We're entitled to do that. and we're entitled to have our rights. And they have not established any basis for privilege as to identity. Well, I come back to the fact that the only cases that have held identity, the crime for identity privilege, are those in which disclosure of the identity would have been incriminating. The only case to otherwise still hold was that Third Circuit case where the service not only had the subject matter of the advice, namely that the law firm involved had been charging fees for tax shelters it was establishing, but also the very substance of the advice, that is, that they had advised that the fees were deductible. And that very peculiar, very similar situation, the Third Circuit held the identity could be kept secret, because otherwise you'd have full disclosure of an otherwise confidential communication that was held to be privileged. That has not been shown here. We know the subject matter of the communications, but we don't know the substance. We might perhaps get at it, but we don't know. We also have the point that when we look at the 7525 privilege, it's clear from the Congress Committee report that Congress did not regard the promotion of tax shelters to be within the ambit of the privilege. You know, the question is less the nature of the advice than the activity of the one giving the purported advice. And we have long distinguished between one who's acting as an independent and dispassionate advisor and one who's a promoter. That is, the courts have dealt with that issue time and time again in the context of accuracy-related penalties and defense against such penalties on the part of a taxpayer who relies upon responsible tax advice. And the courts have always held that if the advisor is not an independent advisor but is a promoter, that there's no basis for relying on that advice. And also, I'd like to address this question of the 7525B exception for corporate tax shelters. Opponents make much, I'm brief, about the fact that that exception only applies to so-called corporate tax shelters, which i.e. shelters where the tax benefit is out of the corporation. And obviously, it can't apply here because at most you're talking S-corps that don't pay tax, benefits will flow through, et cetera, et cetera. That's simply wrong. That is simply wrong. Congress very carefully referenced the definition of tax shelter in Section 66, 62D, 2C, 2i, in that subsection. And that section defines a tax shelter as any plan, entity, arrangement, investment device, the purpose of which is the avoidance or evasion of income tax. It is not restricted by any means to a shelter where the benefit flows through the corporation. That's a hard contrast to the definition of 6111D, which has a definition of corporate tax shelter, which is so restricted. Congress didn't do that. The BNL's own partner filed a declaration indicating that the debtors may well have used engaged in transactions in which corporations were employed. They try to make a distinction between S-corps and C-corps, which is a non-starter in terms of statute. An S-corporation is a corporation is a corporation, and it should be so held for purposes of 7525B. So there simply is no foundation, there's no predicate here for assertion of a privilege as to identity. And I also note that, coming back for a moment to this question of the transactions and the like, not only are these listed transactions, not only do we have information from other investors that, yes, these are transactions that clearly indicate that these are transactions issued and registered and all. They don't deny they engaged in the transactions. None of them deny that they claim benefits from these transactions on their tax returns. You know, what we're talking about here is button, who's got the button, you know, what this is all about is getting the benefits, but trying to avoid scrutiny. And that is not what the privilege is all about. That is certainly not what Congress intended in 1975-25. I think beyond that, the only further point I'd make is what we've been on brief. These summonses were issued over a year ago. Summons, of course, was supposed to be a summary proceeding. We're supposed to be able to proceed with dispatch to try to make a determination in their hands for whether there's a liability. And now, a year later, our process, the production has been stayed. The service is forced, it's handicapped in its investigation.
Well, you do have those that didn't assert the privilege, though, don't you?
Sure. But that doesn't, that's not the be-all and end-all.
It's not the be-all and end-all, but you can't, on one hand, have that information and complain that you don't have it. I mean,
it's not the same information, necessarily. You make the assumption, I don't know what it is, but presumably they're different taxpayers, different customers.
Questioning your argument in that regard, however, even though the summons have been issued, you have been able to proceed with an investigation and obtain, even though it's only partial, but you're not totally inhibited in your investigation.
Not totally, but we're certainly entitled. We shouldn't be inhibited at all. Particularly when we have what I regard as a frivolous claim of privilege of identity. I mean, if I come in as a lawyer asserting attorney-client privilege, we have the usual standards set out by this court in Evans. I'm functioning as a lawyer, that this is information communicated to me in that capacity and providing advice, et cetera, et cetera. And even then, I have to disclose the identity of my client. So for very, very narrow exceptions, we're still applying here. And that's not unusual. That's a commonplace in the law. I mean, just think about the situation Professor Ridmore was addressing in his, when he talked about this issue in his treatise. So now there's a very strong public policy requiring the identity be disclosed. Even while that disclosure discloses something about the motivation requirement, it did something about the confidential advice. It took a simple illustration. If we know that Attorney Jones has been obtained by Sally Smith and has just filed a lawsuit against Sally's ex-husband seeking child support, you know something about Sally's motivation in obtaining Attorney Jones. We know something about the advice they gave her. But that doesn't matter that her identity is privileged. Public policy in that situation, indeed, in all situations, all derives that. We may not be entitled to know her ultimate motivation, the fact that she's really wanted to get together with her ex-husband. We may not be entitled to know the ultimate advice she got from a lawyer, which is that her chances of success were only, say, 10%. So there's not for the privilege to operate, which room. But in the first instance, the policy against keeping a client's identity secret is so strong that we're going to require the identity to disclose, even though in the process may have something about the motivation, yet even something about the advice given by the attorney to that client. Unless that disclosure would incriminate the client or fully disclose the substance of the communication, not just the subject matter. And that's the amount of time.
Thank you, Mr. Seiler. Mr. Rubenstein, you have 3 minutes.
Counsel's reading of the identity privilege is just way too narrow. I don't think there's any question that if we look at the cases in this circuit, the Cherney case, the Tillotson case, the grand jury case, if we look at Liebman even from the Third Circuit, there's no element that this has to be a situation where, but for the privilege, there would be some criminal liability or incriminating statements or any elements like that. There's absolutely no requirement for that. And in fact, in this case, the government says on the one hand that, well, formally what we're interested in is BDO's liability. But, you know, we're really concerned about the time running here because the statute may run on the potential liability of the individual taxpayers. Well, if the government that chooses to conduct an investigation of BDO and to possibly find liability of BDO's clients in this manner, there is another way for them to do it. Under the code, there's a specific procedure for the issuance of John Doe summons. When the service is interested in the potential liability of an unknown taxpayer, you can go to a third party and request information pertaining to that unknown taxpayer. And there are all sorts of protections and procedures under that statute. The government didn't do that. The government has no basis to complain that it's being prevented from conducting its investigation. It's got lots of ways to conduct its investigation, as the court noted. Presumably, it has other ways. It can review tax returns in general and look for red flags on tax returns. It hasn't done that here. There's just no basis to claim that because there's a need here to talk to these clients for the investigation of BDO, we should wipe away the privilege. If that were the case, there would be no privilege with respect to a client and a tax advisor, at least not with respect to so-called tax shelter transactions. And the suggestion that there's some exception for tax shelter transactions in general, it just isn't the case. In fact, Congress specifically recognized in enacting the 7525 privilege that communications with a tax advisor regarding so-called tax shelters could be privileged. Congress exempted corporate tax shelters from that privilege, but it didn't exempt any other kind of tax shelters. Clearly, if Congress had intended that, listen, we want the privilege to apply, but whatever tax shelters are, we don't like them, and therefore it's not going to apply to tax shelters, they didn't do that, and that's not the case here, so there's no question of that. The corporate tax shelter exclusion, whether or not it applies, we don't know on the record. There's no evidence of what entities were used below. But even assuming that there were subchapter S corporations used, if you look at the exception in the privilege, and you look at the legislative history, which we lay out in detail in our brief, which the government doesn't respond to at all, it's clear that what Congress meant by corporate tax shelters were tax shelters which were intended to benefit a corporation. The tax benefit was to flow to the corporation. That's obviously not what happens in the situation of a subchapter S, where the corporation is merely a flow-through, where the entity is no different than if it were a partnership or association. See, my time has expired.
Thank you, Mr. Rubin.
Thank you.
Indeed, our thanks to all counsel for their fine briefs and oral arguments today. The case will be taken under advisement.